7 degrees Kenosha, 54 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to be hearing from best-selling author Tom Clavin talking about his latest book, Throne of Grace. In part two, my guest is Dave Cole, general manager of WGTD. He's going to be talking us through some of the format and schedule changes that go into effect this morning for WGTD and for Wisconsin Public Radio. Please stay tuned for that. Here's part one. I am honored to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with best-selling author Tom Clavin. I have had the great privilege of speaking with Tom Clavin on a number of occasions about just some of the fascinating books that he has written, some of them with his co-author for this latest book, Throne of Grace, Bob Drury. This latest book, Throne of Grace, is subtitled A Mountain Man, An Epic Adventure, and the Bloody Conquest of the American West. The Mountain Man, specified in the subtitle, is one Jedediah Smith, who is probably worthy of being called America's greatest forgotten explorer. We do not know his name the way we know the name of, for instance, Lewis and Clark. And yet Jedediah Smith was an extraordinary figure who accomplished much in his life, and not only in what he himself experienced, but also in terms of how he helped, in a sense, propel the young nation of the United States into the Old West and to embrace this thing known as manifest destiny. In other words, he was a mover and a shaker, probably in ways that he would never have even imagined to be possible. And it is a sprawling, complex story that is told very, very well by our co-authors, Bob Drury and Tom Clavin. I know I have spoken with Tom Clavin before about such bestsellers as Blood and Treasure, and their book Last Men Out, which actually told the story of the last hours of American troops in South Vietnam at the very, very end of the Vietnam conflict. Again, this latest book, published by St. Martin's Press, Throne of Grace, A Mountain Man, An Epic Adventure, and the Bloody Conquest of the American West. Tom Clavin, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Could you just say a word, and I don't remember if we've talked about this before, about your partnership with Bob Drury, and in particular, how you go about the business of writing a book together? Do you each play specific roles? Do you play off of one another, trade off? How does this partnership work?
Well, the partnership has worked the same way it's worked since we first did a book together, and that's going all the way back to I'm going to say it was probably around 2003 in that neighborhood where I was working on a solo project. And I read a few paragraphs in a book by Doug Stanton. It was about the USS Indianapolis. And it made a reference to a typhoon that struck the Third Fleet in the Pacific in December 1944 and sank three ships. And something like 900 sailors went into the water and only 80 were rescued. And I said, I'd never heard about that before. And I knew Bob. We were friends, not great friends, but we knew each other. Well, next time I ran into him, I said, Bob, did you ever hear about this? He said, no, that sounds like a great story. Why don't we do it for, he was a contract writer with Men's Journal at the time. Why don't we collaborate on it and do it as a story for the magazine? And so we did. And our agent, this time we had the same agent, said, let me circulate this article. This is before it even appeared in Men's Journal. and see if somebody wants to turn this into a book. And we did get a publisher interested, and the book became Halsey's Typhoon. And which is our first collaboration. It was published in 2007. And right at the beginning, when we knew that we were going to turn this story into a book, you know, we had to determine, you can't have, we felt you can't have four hands on the keyboard. You know, you can only have two hands on a keyboard at the same time. We also didn't feel it would be a good idea to be trading chapters. Okay, Bob, you write chapters 1, 3, and 5. I'll write chapters 2, 4, and 6. So Bob, I agreed, had a little bit more of a muscular military history kind of style to his writing. So why don't you do most of the writing? I'll do the vast majority of the research. Basically, I set the table, get all the ingredients together, and then Bob cooks the meal. And then it comes back to me for editing. And Halsey's Typhoon came out, and it was a New York Times bestseller. And we said, well, I think we've got a good formula here. Why don't we keep doing it that way, which we've done through all our collaborations together, including the most recent one, Throne of Grace.
Very good. It's a fascinating story. And I know that because you, both of you, obviously have had for quite a long time a fascination with the American Old West and our expansion into the western part of the United States, it's not really a surprise that you would have heard of Jedediah Smith, even if the rest of us do not know the name at all until reading your book. Do you happen to recall when you first came across the story of Jedediah Smith, and at what point it felt like the time is right to finally tell his specific story?
Well, there's a couple of surprises to involved in the creation of Throne of Grace. First one was that Bob and I had done back in 2013, we had a book called The Heart of Everything That Is, which is about the Lakota Sioux and Red Cloud and the Plains Indians from the 1850s into the 1870s. And then in 2021, we published a book called Blood and Treasure about Daniel Boone and his era, which is the 1700s into the early 1800s. And then we moved on. We did a book about World War II. We were actually working on another story that was a World War II story, more like an espionage story. And I remember very distinctly, one day I called Bob and I said, listen, don't shoot me, but I have this idea about putting this book aside that we're working on. Because I said, I guess because this feeling there's a gap between two books that we've already done. Blood and Treasure ends around 1820. Heart of Everything Is begins about 1850 to the 70s. There's that gap in the middle. You know, we never intended to do a trilogy. This is an accident. Throne of Grace completes an accidental trilogy because it covers that period pretty much from 1820 to 1850. And so that was the first surprise to us, that this occurred to us, that we dropped what we were working on, shifted gears to a very different era, and began working on this book. And the other surprise was Jedediah Smith. We wanted to find somebody who, like in our Daniel Boone book, could be our guide to the enormous changes that was taking place in America and in the American West specifically during that period right before the Civil War. And so when we were doing our research, and Jedediah Smith kept popping up in all our research into mountain men and explorers of the 1820s and 1830s, we were fascinated by his achievements and his accomplishments and saying, why doesn't anybody really know this guy? I mean, you mentioned Lewis and Clark earlier. Everybody knows the names Lewis and Clark and teach them in history books. But Jedediah Smith was sort of like outdid Lewis and Clark as far as the extent and the duration of his explorations. But he was unfortunately lost to the mists of time. And so that was the second surprise to us, that we found a character who we can hang our story on who was so remarkable.
There are a lot of things that set him apart, and that's one of the things you talk about, is he stood out from a lot of his fellow so-called mountain men. I mean, in terms of being a morally upright, deeply, devoutly religious young man, and someone who had a character which made him, in some respects, an ideal leader in some of these situations, although in some respects, who he was made some of that even more challenging. You mentioned when you talk about his childhood, he was born, I think, in 1799, how he was given a very special gift as a boy, a gift which made a huge impression on him, and in a sense, probably served as an inspiration for much of what he would go on to achieve as an explorer. Explain to our listeners about this special book.
Well, I'm pretty sure you're referring to the journals of Lewis and Clark.
Yes.
Which I should point out that the Lewis and Clark journals is one of the reasons why Lewis and Clark became so well known. I mean, yes, they did that very first journey to the West Coast and back in 1803 to 1806. Remarkable and one of the most amazing feats of exploration in American history, certainly. And they published a few years later their journals, which, you know, again, made them famous all over again. And Jedediah Smith was given a copy of their journals. And this along with the Bible, which he always kept with him, was a pivotal piece of literature, information, adventurous narrative. And he became fascinated with it. And he's decided, I mean, he'd grown up basically in a farming family. He was not going to spend the rest of his life behind the plow. He wanted to find out what was out there. You know, even though Lewis and Clark had made their expedition, the Corps of Discovery expedition, there's so much they had not explored. I mean, let's face it, it took them 28 months to go to the West Coast and back, and even so, there was so much more of America, the American West, they didn't see. They didn't explore. They didn't get to it. So there were still stories about the American West, like it's inhabited by fantastic creatures and giant beasts and giant people and all kinds of strange critters and predators. So he was one of the many young men who wanted to find out what was out there. He was distinctive in that he wasn't like those other mountain men. He wasn't this big, burly character you see portrayed in the movies. They usually had long beards and disgusting clothing and spitting all the time and drinking all the time. That wasn't him at all. He was kind of like the gentleman mountain man, and somewhat slight in stature, although kind of a bit tall for the age. And he didn't, as you said, he was a very religious man. And in fact, the title of the book, Throne of Grace, comes towards later in his life when he's writing a letter to his brother. He talks about how he wanted to live a life of virtue and of honesty and of doing good deeds so that perhaps he'd be lucky enough that when he dies, he'd be able to sit near the throne of grace, meaning he'd be near God in the afterlife.
Hmm. So he makes his way ultimately to St. Louis in 1822. And you quote somebody, I don't remember now off the top of my head who it was, but somebody describing St. Louis at this point in the early 19th century as the pad where great expectations were outfitted and adventures launched, the place where westering fever burned at its highest pitch. And what had brought young Jedediah Smith to St. Louis was answering an ad, essentially, for somebody who was launching a venture involving the lucrative beaver trade. And this is something actually here in southeastern Wisconsin we know something about. For many years we had a summertime event of historic reenactors, and it was called the Pike River Rendezvous, which really seeked to kind of show people what the fur trade was like, at least in this part of the world. But we are talking about the fur trade expanding into the Old West, and of course that was a very different sort of venture at that point in time.
It was. I mean, it's kind of remarkable to think that a big part of what motivated a lot of the exploring that was being done of the American West was the search for beaver. The beaver was in high demand. Well, beaver pelts for hats and for scarves were in enormously high demand in Europe at the time. And so these American mountain men, they weren't going west strictly to explore. In fact, if anything, exploring was the secondary motivation. The first motivation was to try and find and trap and skin as many beaver as possible, bring them back to St. Louis, which was the launching point and also the destination when you're coming back from the West, and sell them. And you'd make as much money as you could. If some people went back out to the mountains, some people said, I've got enough money, I'm going to go open a dry goods store. So the quest for beaver was the huge motivating factor in the 1820s and 1830s that had people like Jedediah Smith. I mean, Jedediah Smith had enormous curiosity, but he also realized I have to make a living, and he became one of these great hunters and explorers of beaver. And the beaver trade was enormously powerful in the United States until about 1840, when inevitably, as we found what happened years later with the buffalo, the beaver was almost killed into extinction.
It's an interesting scene you describe when when Jedediah Smith sits down with one of the men who's really organizing all of this. And I love your turn of phrase when this Mr. Ashley kind of comes to understand this youngster, Jedediah Smith. You write that he saw in this gangly Easterner a self-possession rare in a man of his age who might provide a deep keel in rough seas. That is, I mean, when we're talking about an expedition in which one was, in a sense, sailing off into the unknown and a tremendously dangerous unknown, that somebody like Jedediah Smith might actually have some real gifts that would be that would come in handy. And indeed, that proves to be the case, at least in some respects. Describe this landscape, not just the physical landscape, much of it to some extent unknown, but of course also the indigenous people living on that land, many different tribes, many of them with very different customs and attitudes. It made for an almost unimaginably dangerous unknown in which to be traveling.
It was, and William Ashley, it was a bit of a stretch that he would think somebody as young as Jedediah Smith, who I think was 22 at the time that Ashley first encountered him and gave him the job to come in their beaver hunting, fur trapping expedition. They turned out to be correct, though. Jedediah Smith is the book, I mean, the Throne of Grace is really a big adventure story. There's a lot of action in it. And some of that action involved Jedediah Smith being involved in fights against Indian tribes, fights that he was attacked by a grizzly bear. There's conflict with Russians and Brits and Scots and Indians that were trying to come in the back door on the west coast of the United States because the indigenous tribes is an important part of our story because that's really where we put the subtitle, The Bloody Conquest, because there were a lot of battles. Now, some of these tribes, I should point out, I wouldn't say necessarily welcomed these strange, unfamiliar white hunters and explorers, but they were accommodating enough, especially there were times that Smith survived because he and his party stumbled upon an Indian village that might not have had much food themselves, but what they had, they shared with Smith and his fellow travelers. And some of the tribes, especially like the Comanche and the Blackfeet, were immediately, and to some extent justifiably, hostile to these, what they saw as these intruders. They worried what was going to happen to their hunting grounds if they left these people. And every time they turned around, there seemed to be more of them, these hunters and explorers coming into their territory. So we have scenes where the Jedediah Smith or some of the other mountain men are encountering the Indian tribes, and it sometimes it ended up being a battle, and brutal ones, involving all kinds of violence and dismemberments and beheadings and things like that. So it was indeed a bloody conquest that as we all know now, and as our the heart of everything that is concludes, that our trilogy concludes, it was ultimately a conquest, a bloody one, and it resulted in the Indians, most of the indigenous people in the Western United States being forced onto reservations. You can see in Throne of Grace, not that reservations have begun that soon early in the history, but that the tribes are being, they're being, concentrated into smaller and smaller pieces of land or being driven out of their hunting ground and traditional areas altogether. So the story of the indigenous tribes and the Native American tribes is a really important part of the Throne of Grace.
Right. And one of the things you talk about in terms of Jedediah Smith is that he was a very observant young man.
Yes.
And especially when it came to various tribes, you write, the observant Smith was determined to learn various secrets, surely intuiting that identifying one so-called Indian from another at a glance could mean the difference between life and death. This was the beginning of his education. That is, it was a huge mistake to think of all of the indigenous people of the continent, in kind of a careless generality, when in fact each of these tribes had their own particular cultures, their own particular array of values, and it was important to understand those differences and respect them. I want to give you a chance to talk about a really important chapter in the book in which you are talking about some of the dramatic changes occurring at this point in time. It's chapter 3 called The Horse and the Gun. Mm. And indeed, the horse and the gun are what you call two groundbreaking factors that really helped change everything. Explain the significance of the horse and the gun to understanding this period of our history.
Well, the way Indians have usually been portrayed in the movies, for example, has made it seem like every Indian in North America always had a horse. And that really was not true, especially for the tribes in the East, the tribes in the Midwest, the tribes in the Southeast. There was something that we discuss in more detail in that chapter called the Great Horse Dispersal. And this was when the Spanish in the Southwest United States, as they were sort of losing territory, they basically, all the horses they had obtained that they had brought over from Europe and bred in Southwest, they let them go. They said, "Get out of here! We're cutting back, scaling back our operation here. Chase the horses away. Let them fend for themselves." And so, from the Southwest, spreading north and east, were horses, and they would breed and they would multiply. And one tribe after another encountered these horses, they realized what an enormous benefit horses could be. This, of course, for traveling from place to place, going for hunting buffalo, for example. I mean, it's a lot better to hunt buffalo on top of a horse than to just wait for a buffalo to come to you. And the other thing is that you could make war with horses. And so one of the reasons why there was a lot of conflict between tribes themselves is they were trying to steal each other's horses. Horses could be pack animals, which is enormously, previously when let's say a tribe was going from its summer home to its winter home, dogs were the pack animals. Well, they only carry so much. Horses could carry much more. So that was an important part of the evolution of the Indian tribes in North America. The other one was, of course, when guns became available to them. The Europeans had guns for centuries, but using gunpowder and a bullet and a rifle or a pistol was totally alien to the Indian tribes. However, they would start trading for these guns because, they were weapons. They were advanced weapons, and they could be more to their advantage than, let's say, the traditional bow and arrow or lances. And so some of the tribes, the Comanche, the Sioux, that became experts at using both guns and horses became very, very popular. We start to see in Throne of Grace which tribes are starting to outgain the others. Some became agricultural, some became nomadic, some became kind of militaristic. And so they, especially the ones who are militaristic, were the ones like the Blackfeet and the Sioux are saying, "We don't want these white men on our territory. We don't care what they're looking for. We don't care what they want. They just got to turn around and go back where they came from." And but more white men kept showing up, and that led to some bloody battles.
It sure did. At one point, you write, "As in the eastern forests, gun possession on the prairie naturally exacerbated centuries-old rivalries and blood feuds." And there is no question, of course, that the introduction of the gun was very important. And you say at one point, it was left to the British, French, and Dutch traders to arm the continent tribe by tribe. Something else I want to talk about for just a couple of minutes. Later in the book, some myths die hard. Ponce de Leon's Fountain of Youth, the Northwest Passage, the Seven Cities of Gold. Such was the case of the Rio Buenaventura. The river of good fortune. I'd actually never heard of this until I read this book, Throne of Grace. It's such an interesting phenomenon when people just end up embracing this widespread belief that something exists when in fact there's no proof of it, and in many cases it turns out not to be true at all. And such was the case with this so-called River of Good Fortune. Explain this myth. It's a fascinating thing.
Until it was disproved, which took decades, mapmakers would always include the Rio Buenaventura on their maps. And basically what that meant was there was a belief that that there was a waterway that connected, let's say, the Missouri River. You could start at the Missouri River in St. Louis, and through interconnected waterways, you would end up on the west in the Pacific Ocean. That conceivably you know, you could get take a boat from St. Louis to Los Angeles, or you know, what was the location that became Los Angeles. And the idea of finding now, what if you could do this? Of course, that means you could go bring goods and trade goods and bring goods back. Just climb up and over mountains, and you'd have to go across, you know, trek across deserts. You could just get on this river and take it one way, and then when you're ready, come back the other way. This huge water slide that went for 2,000 miles west, east and west, and so many people took off in search of this, and the William Ashley and Jedediah Smith and some of the other mountain men were no stranger. I mean, when Jim Bridger was the first white man supposedly to encounter the Great Salt Lake, and he thought that the Great Salt Lake was at first the Pacific Ocean.
Hmm.
And that he had found it. Yeah. Hey, look, it's true. There is. I did take this river all the way to Utah. And here's the Great Salt Lake. Of course, he found out from traveling around it that it was in an enclosed, contained body of water, but it was salt water.
Hmm.
So it's amazing how many people tried it, how many people died in the pursuit of the insistence that there was such a river, such a waterway. And it wasn't really until Jedediah Smith and some of the explorers that came after him, like Kit Carson and John C. Fremont, who finally discovered that there just was no interconnected waterway like that. It just simply did not exist. And what a disappointment that was to many people.
Right, including Thomas Jefferson himself, who fervently believed that such a thing existed.
Did.
Well, of course, Jedediah Smith goes on to extraordinary travels and adventures, escapes with his life time and time again. He ultimately mm-hmm. makes his way all the way to the West Coast, to both sides of the Rocky Mountains, and explores so much. And you take us all the way up to his eventual death in 1831 on his last expedition. A quick last question, if I could.
Sure.
I'm just curious, when it comes to somebody like Jedediah Smith, largely forgotten by history, as we've already talked about, your book takes us step by step, in some cases nearly day by day, through so much of what Jedediah experienced in his years as an explorer, hunter, and trapper. How do we know as much as we know? I mean, what were the most sort of fertile sources of information for you in telling his story so vividly in Throne of Grace?
Well, very fortunate for historians like us about this era of the mountain man is that while many of these, if not most of the mountain men, were illiterate, some of them were not, and some of those were kept journals. Jedediah Smith himself kept journals of his travels, some of which did not survive, but some did. Some of his other fellow mountain men were journal keepers, and sometimes their language was uneducated language, but they was could be quite vivid about what they were observing, what they experienced. And so enough journals survived from these men in the 1820s and 1830s that you could put a pretty good picture together. And so, especially some expeditions had more than one people keeping journals about the same expedition. So you get different perspectives. You know, one person can have a certain perspective on an adventure that they were on, and another one has a different perspective on it. So it was really, it's really fortunate that, A, that so many journals were kept by these otherwise illiterate group of men, and, B, that they managed to survive and be preserved for centuries, really.
Well, we really get to know Jedediah Smith, and we really get to know other colorful characters as well. And we learn so much about our nation at this point in its history, and about the incredible courage and sometimes foolishness that was part of the experience of so many explorers making their way through this part of the continent. The book, again, is titled Throne of Grace, A Mountain Man, An Epic Adventure, and the Bloody Conquest of the American West, published by St. Martin's Press. The co-authors, Bob Drury, and my morning show guest, Tom Clavin. Tom Clavin, congrats on yet another fascinating book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today to talk about it.
Thank you. It's been a privilege for me.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're finishing out today with the boss, namely the general manager of WGTD, David Cole. And it's no coincidence that he is on the morning show today because, as many of you know, or I hope know by now, today, the 20th of May, marks a new era for Wisconsin Public Radio and for WGTD, with some fairly significant changes in format, changes that are underway at Wisconsin Public Radio itself, with which we are an affiliate, of course. And so these changes also mean changes in terms of our scheduled day here at WGTD. So we're just going to be talking through a few of those specifics with David Cole. Thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Glad to be here.
So maybe you could first talk a little bit about the timeline in terms of if you even roughly remember when you first heard from Wisconsin Public Radio about the possibility that some significant changes were on the horizon.
I think this first surfaced maybe about a year ago. And Tom Lujack, then the interim director of Wisconsin Public Radio, paid a visit to WGTD and basically laid out what was going on. And by then, the wheels had been turning for quite some time. And they knew they needed to do something in order to increase audience and kind of get with the times. As it turns out, Wisconsin Public Radio was one of the few networks around the country that still had a hybrid format, that being NPR News and classical music. And they went through a process that involved focus groups, it involved speaking to consultants, it involved taking a look at best practices around the country. And we were told at that time that more than likely the network was going to realign itself into one network that featured news and talk and another network that featured music. One of the problems with the format that we have had here at WGTD and throughout the state is you've got people listening to Morning Edition, and you know they appreciate the program and the information and how it's presented, and then we hit a, if you will, a brick wall at either 9 or 10 with classical music. And I mean, I've had people say they love the talk, but then they flip the radio off or to something else when classical music comes on. And then we've had the reverse as well. People who love classical music and they just despise or don't like the chatter. So as Sarah Ashworth, the new director of Wisconsin Public Radio, you know, explained, it just makes sense to have one network that features music and another network that's news and talk oriented.
So when people turn on the radio and turn on, for instance, 91.1, there's no guesswork involved about what they're going to find.
Right, right. And we weren't told that we had to become part of the new news network, but you know, we were given a choice. But very right off the bat, it just made so much sense to do what they were suggesting and align ourselves with the news and talk network.
So explain some specifics in terms of how the program schedule for WGTD looks now, that is on Monday, May 20th, versus what it was like on last Monday, May 13th.
Sure. Well, there's been no change so far this morning. You know, if you listened at 6 o'clock, even earlier, you would have heard NPR's Morning Edition, and you also would have heard Dave McGrath doing our local breaks. Your show remains between 8, 10, and 9, obviously. And just a few minutes, we will go back into network and a new show will premiere, Wisconsin Today, and that's the beginning of our talk format. Wisconsin Today, which will have a format very similar to Morning Edition and All Things Considered, will be Wisconsin-centric. That'll air from 9 until 10, and then we will go into some national talk at 10 o'clock, which is called bear with me here. I'm still getting used to the schedule myself.
Right.
But it's called 1A Plus.
And that's, depending on what stations people have listened to, they will be, to some extent at least, familiar with that program as it has appeared before.
Mm-hmm.
But the program you mentioned, 9 to 10, that's a brand new program that has never existed before.
Correct. Yeah, and we're really looking forward to hearing that for the first time and welcoming that program to WGTD. At 11 o'clock, the Larry Mueller Show hits our air. And if you listen to the Ideas Network, Larry is a very popular Wisconsin public radio host.
And he's been there forever.
He's been there forever. And his show is kind of a call-in, consumer-oriented, how-to-do-it kind of gardening show.
It's home improvement, lots of different things.
A lot of things, yeah. And his show actually is being expanded a half hour. So he'll be on the air from 11 until 1. Now, that means that the Midday News with Dave McGrath is going to be shortened. We will preempt the NPR News at 12:01 and state news to bring a six-minute local newscast, which will basically focus on breaking news. And also, we will have a full-length WGTD Market Minute with Bob Hagerty. So it's going to be really focused on business news and then breaking news and a top story. And that's because we don't want to interrupt Larry Mueller.
Right.
You know, we need to take the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter a Day is another casualty of, you know, this format change that had aired at 12:30 forever on WGTD. And that actually is being moved to 9:30 weeknights.
So then after Larry Mueller, it's still more talk and information over the course of the afternoon hours. Can you tell us some of those specifics?
That is correct. We have On Point at 1 o'clock, Monday through Thursday. And on Fridays, we have Science Friday. That'll hit the air. At 2 o'clock, we have The World. And Monday through Thursday, and then the second hour of Science Friday. And all things considered, we'll be moved up an hour. We will bump the BBC at 3 o'clock, and we'll take the first hour of All Things Considered then. And nothing changes through 6:30. Marketplace remains at 6:30. 7 o'clock, we have a repeat of Wisconsin Today. And then at 8 o'clock, and this is a change, we'll hear Fresh Air with Terry Gross. And that program is being pushed back an hour for anyone who is a Fresh Air devotee. And then we've got a new program that I'm not familiar with called Today Explained. It's a half-hour program at 11, at make that 9 o'clock, and then at 9:30 it's Chapter a Day. And by 11 o'clock, we've bounced back into the BBC, and we'll stick with them all night long.
Very good. So that gives us kind of a rough idea, not a rough idea, a fairly specific idea of the daytime schedule for WGTD. We want to reiterate that early morning listeners to WGTD of Morning Edition and The Morning Show will hear no changes whatsoever, or nothing significant anyway. It is still Morning Edition and The Morning Show as you have listened to them and enjoyed them up until now. We should talk about the weekend, and that's a little more complicated picture, but I'm sure a lot of WGTD listeners will be relieved to hear that at least a lot of our weekend programming is going to remain in place.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into that, I kind of like to talk a little bit about classical music, you know, what we're leaving behind on WGTD HD1.
Good idea.
Part of the network realignment is WHAD in Milwaukee 90.7 is going to become a classical music station. Many of these programs that you're going to be hearing on WGTD are coming from the Ideas Network and WHAD. So if somebody, you know, wants to listen to classical music in this area, they ought to tune into our sister station, WHAD, at 90.7. Now, we do realize that that signal fades a little bit in southern Kenosha County and certainly in the northern tier of communities in Lake County. And so that's why we are rebroadcasting this new music network on WGTD 91.1 HD3. And so if you happen to have an HD radio, tune into HD3 and you'll hear basically what's a rebroadcast of WPR music from that network. And there are many other ways to listen to classical music as well. You can call it up on your smart speaker. And I've learned that, and that's how I've been listening to WGTD for a long time myself, even though I do have a radio, lest there be any doubt. But I understand that different brands of smart speakers behave differently. And WPR.org lays all that out and provides kind of a tutorial. And so if you do go to WPR.org and click Ways to Listen, you'll get the full picture. You can also listen online. Go to WPR.org and click their music network, and they also have a phone app as well. So we're not abandoning the classical music audience. And personally, I'm going to miss classical music on WGTD, but you know, this move just makes a lot of sense.
It really does. I want to just add on a personal note, although I've experienced a little bit of grief, I didn't even realize how much I enjoyed hosting the Music Potpourri until suddenly its days were numbered. But this is a change that to me makes a tremendous amount of sense, and so it's something that I am embracing and applauding, and to whatever extent I can, even welcoming. And but we do hope that people who really have enjoyed listening to classical music over WGTD all these years will seek out these other ways to hear the fine classical music programming that comes from Wisconsin Public Radio. And so we want to reiterate all of that.
Well, and I certainly want to mention that we certainly appreciate your efforts over all these years hosting Music Potpourri and the expertise that you've brought to the radio station as a fine arts director.
It's been fun. I was just thinking, by the way, when I started here in 1986, the Music Potpourri was actually 10 until 12. And then we had an afternoon musicale that was 1 until 3. So we had 4 hours of local classical music programming. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as we more fully affiliated with Wisconsin Public Radio and as other changes were necessary, all of that, of course, changed dramatically. And the balance of our classical music programming, the vast majority of it, has come from Madison for quite some time now. In fact, for a good more than 20 years. So anyway, you can still seek out that fine programming very, very easily, and we hope people will do that.
And just to provide some context, you know, I came from commercial radio, WLIP. I was there for 21, 22 years. So I was kind of on the sideline when WGTD essentially affiliated itself with Wisconsin Public Radio. And you were here, Greg, and so, you know, you lived through it. The decision was made to back in the early 90s that Gateway Technical College just couldn't afford to go it alone. And that's,
right. At that time, we were a full freestanding a public radio station with no affiliation with Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yeah. And the college president at that time made the decision to strike this agreement with Wisconsin Public Radio. The bad news was, you know, I think you had mentioned that two-thirds of the staff went bye-bye permanently. And, you know, the classical music started being played by Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison.
Right.
And at that point, you know, the radio station was able to focus more heavily on local. And I've been here since 2001, and that's been our focus. You know, we're still a classical music station, but most of our hours actually are devoted to local news and public affairs and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. And, of course, my efforts here at Wisconsin at WGTD have been focused very much on the morning show.
Sure.
And I'm, again, happy to say that the morning show is going nowhere. It is it's remaining in place exactly as it has been for quite some time. So on to the weekend, and what do you want to tell us about Saturday and Sunday programming?
Well, it's quite a schedule. Starting Saturday morning, we've got Garden Talk at 5 o'clock with Larry Mueller, and that essentially is going to be a repeat of Friday's Larry Mueller show. So Garden Talk will run from 5 through 7 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, again, this is a part of the schedule that doesn't change. You'll hear Weekend Edition Saturday. 9 o'clock, we're excited about this, the very popular NPR program Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me hits the air at 9 o'clock. And then our local block of programming between 10 and noon, where we have a number of different shows, that remains the same. And then at noon, we go into the People's Pharmacy, another popular show, and Zorba Pastor with his health-related show at 1. And then we have Hidden Brain at 2, to the best of our knowledge, at 3, which our listeners are well familiar with. We stick with Weekend Edition, All Things Considered, at 4. 5 o'clock, a program called Snap Judgment. 6, the Moth Radio Hour. And again, 7 o'clock Saturday, we will stick with jazz. Our local block of jazz programming actually is going to be expanded by an hour. So instead of jumping to a network show at 11 o'clock to take us through 1 a.m. in the morning, we will do a series of rotating hosts that have been producing programs for a long time on HD2. Hmm. And so they're finally going to get some airplay on WGTD. So again, we'll have jazz from 7 o'clock Saturday night through midnight. And I think we've got the, we'll have the BBC overnight. And then on Sunday, we'll have a lot of shows that are repeated from Saturday. One show that would hit the air that is not repeated is called On the Media. That's a 6 o'clock Sunday morning. It's a very sharp show. Weekend Edition Sunday, we'd stick with that at 7 o'clock. And to the best of our knowledge, at 9, Beta at 10, Away with Words at 11. We'll have a repeat of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Sunday at noon. Another show that WGTD used to carry when I arrived on the scene, This American Life, is at 2 o'clock on Sunday. Radiolab, 3 o'clock. The Weekend Edition, as it has been airing, at 4 o'clock. A program called University of the Air at 5. A repeat of Zorba Pastor at 6. This is Sunday night. Live Wire at 7. Code Switch Life Kit at 8. It's Been a Minute at 9. And a show that I'm not familiar with, PRX Remix. So I'm interested in learning what that's about.
So if people have their heads swimming from all of this information, I suspect you have a couple of suggestions for them in terms of getting clarification on all of these changes.
Sure.
Where should they go? What should they
do? We will have our new schedule posted shortly at WGTD.org. I think that's the main resource. And otherwise, listen. So,
very good. Well, I appreciate you taking time out of what I know has been a really hectic time. Mm-hmm. You and our engineer, Dave Janzer, have been really hard at work to help put together all of the technical matters that are necessary for this changeover to occur smoothly and without interruption. So thanks for taking the time to offer this information. David Cole, General Manager of WGTD. For part two of today's morning show here on WGTD, FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. Remind you that the morning show is archived on our website, WGTD.org, and you can also subscribe to the morning show podcast. Look for the morning show with Greg Berg. It's going to remain a cloudy day, rain showers and some storms expected through much of the day, and a high temperature today of 77 degrees. Overnight, a 50% chance of still more rain and thunderstorms, low of 62. Tomorrow, Tuesday, a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Tomorrow's high temperature, 81 degrees, cooler near the lake. Then sunshine is expected to return for Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and some of Saturday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News.